online these days. You should try it, Mum. Click, click, and you're done. And Amy apparently got her clothes by scrounging through charity bins, so Joy had given up suggesting shopping excursions. But when Joy had suggested she'd treat Savannah to a day at a fancy shopping mall to thank her for everything she'd done while Joy was in the hospital, Savannah's face had lit up, even as she quickly said, "Oh, that's not necessary." "It would be my pleasure," Joy had said, truthfully, because today had been like rediscovering a forgotten part of herself. The part that perhaps only existed when she was with her mother, who had no interest in Joy's tennis, or even, to be honest, Joy's children, but did have passionate opinions about the right colours and necklines to flatter Joy's body. Joy had assumed her daughters would at least have a passing interest in fashion, but they both found it frivolous and irrelevant, almost contemptible, like playing with dolls, which neither of them had done either. Joy had spent hours playing with dolls as a child. "I know exactly the right necklace to go with your shift dress," said Joy to Savannah. "A long kind of heavy, chunky pendant that sits right here." She pointed at her collarbone. "Although I've noticed you nearly always wear that key necklace, don't you? Is it sentimental?" Savannah's young face became momentarily rigid and jaded, as if she were 30 years older. "A friend gave it to me for my 21st birthday." She lifted the key from her neck and tapped it against her chin. She said it symbolized doors opening for a brighter future. She smiled cynically at Joy. "I'm still waiting for those doors to open." "I'm sure lots of doors are about to open for you," said Joy. She recognised the rousing tone she used to employ to little avail when Amy got the bad feeling. "Well, you opened your door to me." Savannah's face softened. "So that's a start. Maybe I could get a green pendant." She bent towards the shopping bags, pulled out a corner of the dress and pointed at the fabric. "To pick out the green colour of those little squares. What do you think?" "Perfect," said Joy, and her eyes filled with unexpected tears as she felt a thin, sharp, strangely pleasurable piercing of grief for her mother, who would have loved this day so much, who might have found it so much easier to bond with a granddaughter like this. Her mother had died over 20 years ago, and Joy's grief at the time had been so complicated and strange. Her mother hadn't been an especially good mother, and she was an even worse grandmother. She found her grandchildren too loud and too large, and so excessive in number. "Why would you want more?" she'd said to Joy when she told her she was pregnant with Brooke. When she died, just 3 months after Stan's mother had died, Joy kept spinning in the opposite direction when faced with her grief, which was hers and hers alone, because she had no siblings, and her children much preferred their other grandmother because of the secret cash handouts and that damned apple crumble. It was perfectly possible to avoid grief when you have 4 children who all play competitive tennis and nearly 100 more tennis students requiring your attention and 1 husband grieving his own mother and dealing with his own mid-bloody life crisis, and when your relationship with your mother had always been entangled in disappointment and love. So Joy spun, and she spun until one day her grief caught her in the laundry as she pulled a ruined blouse out of the washing machine, a blouse that her mother had told her to only ever wash by hand in cold water. It was as though Joy's subconscious had only just that moment caught up with what she rationally understood, that she truly wouldn't see her mother again. Her mother would never again phone at an inconvenient time with an unreasonable request. She would never again tell Joy that she hated February, or that she hated August, or that she hated November. She only liked April. Pearl Becker would never find the happiness that had continually eluded her, and their relationship would remain a puzzle forever unsolved. That day, Joy had lowered herself to the floor with her back against the washing machine, the sodden ball of her ruined blouse dripping all over her skirt, and sobbed, violently and shockingly. And then, shamefully, she'd shouted at a tennis kid who'd unexpectedly opened the laundry door and caught her there. It was a wonder she hadn't got a complaint from that kid's mother. But this sadness she was feeling now felt natural, wholesome, and uncomplicated, as if finally, after all these years, she was grieving the way normal daughters grieved for their mothers, the way she'd like her own daughters to grieve for her one day, not coldly stuffing their mother's clothes into a big black garbage bag the way Joy had done the day after her mother's funeral, without a single tear or even a tender thought, but also not crying on the laundry floor weeks later in that strange paroxysm of grief that would have so mortified her mother. "Get up," Pearl would have cried, yanking Joy up by the elbow. "Someone might see you." "Thank you," Joy leaned back as the waitress delivered their apple crumble. She said to Savannah, "I know just the shop for that necklace. We'll go there straight after this." "Well, only if that's okay," said Savannah, suddenly looking uncomfortable. "You've already spent quite a lot on me. Your children might not approve." "Darling, I should be paying you a salary," said Joy. "You are like a full-time chef and housekeeper. This is the least I can do." "Well, but don't forget I'm getting free rent," said Savannah. "I'm the one getting the bargain here," said Joy stoutly. She thought of Brooke on the phone this morning. "Mom, if you actually want to employ this girl as a housekeeper, or whatever you want to call it, you need to do it properly." Of course Joy couldn't employ Savannah as a full-time chef or housekeeper. She didn't know anyone with a housekeeper. That was for movie stars and Americans, possibly people from the eastern suburbs, not for ordinary people like her and Stan. However, it had occurred to her last night that perhaps they could let Savannah stay as a kind of lodger. Why not? Savannah could get a job somewhere local and stay in Amy's room and pay nominal rent or no rent at all if she kept on doing the cooking. But Stan wasn't at all keen. He said when they were in bed last night, the door shut, that it had been over 6 weeks now, and it was probably time for Savannah to think about finding her own place. "But why the rush?" Joy had said, taken aback. She thought he enjoyed Savannah's company as much as she did, but since she'd come back from the hospital, he'd become more reserved around Savannah. All that chattiness had stopped. He found excuses not to join them at mealtimes. He and Savannah didn't seem to be watching that television series together anymore. It was such a pity. "Did something happen while I was in hospital?" Joy had asked him.
"Like what?" said Stan, his jaw clenched.
"I don't know," she said. "You just don't seem as happy about Savannah as you were in the beginning."
"She's been here long enough," said Stan. "That's all I'm saying."
It had been so odd. After a moment, she'd said, "Have you been talking to the children?" The children were being such children about Savannah. She could not believe that Amy had accused Savannah of making up the story about her boyfriend based on some documentary Logan had supposedly seen with a similar story, as if there couldn't be similarities in people's experiences. Stan had said nothing, and she refused to give him the satisfaction of innocently, idiotically repeating the question a little louder, the way she would have when she was 20, or yelling, "Answer me," like she would have when she was 40. She was sure she was right.
The children had got to him, and that's what accounted for his sudden coolness toward Savannah. He was more influenced by their opinions than he liked to pretend. He would argue vehemently with one of them about a particular issue, and then, just a month or so later, spout the very same argument presented by one of the children as if it were his own, and categorically deny that he had ever said or thought otherwise. It was all very well for Stan to say that Savannah had been there long enough. He wasn't the one who would be back in the kitchen at 5 p.m. every day, staring with despair and boredom at the refrigerator's contents, sliding the vegetable crisper open and closed, hoping for inspiration. This hatred of cooking must represent something else, because why get so worked up about it now, after all these years? Once upon a time, Joy was up at 5 a.m. every day. She'd coach class after class, deal with the laundry, the dog, the accountant, the homework, her mother, her mother-in-law, and then she'd cook dinner for a family of six. At a minimum, there were always extra people at the table, and she'd done it without conscious resentment or complaint. Now that it was only ever her and Stan at home, cooking should feel like a breeze. She had whole days at her disposal to plan and prepare, to pore over recipe books if she chose, the way Savannah pored over her beloved recipe books. So many for a girl so young, with such focus and pleasure, her mouth hanging slightly open as if she were reading a romance novel. Joy had time to wander about specialty supermarkets looking for unusual ingredients, except she wanted to cry with boredom at the thought. What was wrong with her? She thought of Brooke's brisk, surprised suggestion that they try some sort of meal delivery service, or, if she wanted a housekeeper, hire one. According to her children, anything could be fixed online. They were always reaching for answers on their phones. They couldn't go more than 5 minutes without looking something up. I'll look it up, Mum. I've got it. I've booked it. I've ordered it. They tap, tap, tapped with their thumbs, and it was done. There was no need for her elderly fuss. I've been meaning to thank you for taking care of Stan while I was in hospital, said Joy now to Savannah. I hope he wasn't too grumpy. He can be grumpy. It was no trouble, said Savannah. Joy couldn't read her face. Had he been grumpy with her? Or just odd? He could be strange, and young people weren't patient with strangeness. They wanted clear-cut explanations for everything, including exactly why people behaved the way they did. They hadn't yet learned that sometimes there were no answers. My daughters would say that he shouldn't need anyone to take care of him, said Joy. But he's from a different generation. No help in the kitchen at all. She paused, reflected. He's good at opening jars. She wondered how Debbie Christos was going without Dennis there to open jars. Debbie had dainty wrists. Joy should tell her to call Stan any time she wanted a jar opened. Any time. How is the apple crumble? Asked Savannah. Because she knew about the family's quest to replicate Grandma's apple crumble. It's a good one, said Joy, but still missing something. She licked her spoon. Actually, it's not even close, to be honest. I don't know why she could make such a good crumble. She couldn't bake anything else. She was a nasty old drunk. Yet for some reason, her apple crumble tasted of love. It was a mystery. Maybe the secret ingredient is some kind of alcohol, said Savannah. Whiskey? Joy pointed her spoon at her. Now that would make sense. Clever. I'm going to try it this weekend, said Savannah, and Joy could see that she'd pleased her by calling her clever. I'm going to crack the Delaney family apple crumble mystery. Joy watched Savannah touch her spoon with the tip of her tongue and put it down again. She didn't really eat. All she did was cook. She was too thin. Joy wanted to tell her she was too thin, but she'd learned that you had to be careful what you said. Amy and Brooke had once overheard Joy saying, "My daughters have enormous feet," and she'd never heard the end of it. She hadn't meant anything bad by it. They did have enormous feet. "You don't eat much, do you?" she said to Savannah. Surely that wasn't offensive. For someone who loves to cook so much, I mean. "I used to have a big appetite when I was a kid." Savannah dug her spoon into her apple crumble and swirled it around. Did she think Joy couldn't tell that she wasn't actually eating? "I was always hungry." She looked at Joy with a fixed, almost belligerent expression, and Joy backed down. Perhaps she'd accidentally body-shamed. There were a lot of new rules for life, and she hadn't caught up on all of them. Her children, who had come into the world completely uncivilized and learned all their good manners from her, sometimes cried, "Mum, you can't say that!" She always laughed as if she didn't give two hoots, but in truth, these inadvertent transgressions upset and embarrassed her. "How long had you been going out with that boy?" she asked Savannah. "The one who..." She touched her own eyebrow where Savannah's injury had been. "About a year?" Savannah's face was impassive. She scraped a spoonful of froth from her cappuccino. "Had he ever hurt you before?" She wasn't checking up on her story, absolutely not. She was just asking questions, trying to understand her. Savannah put down her spoon and said, "Can I ask you a question about your marriage?" Joy had that odd feeling again that here was the real Savannah, relaxing for a moment, being her true self, taking off her mask. "Go right ahead," she said expansively. "Was there ever any infidelity?" "Oh," said Joy. She wiped her mouth with her napkin and sat back. "It's a very personal question, I know," said Savannah. It was a personal question, but Joy had just been asking Savannah personal questions about her relationship, so why shouldn't she ask them back? "No," she said, and it was no problem at all to bat away that blurry, shameful image of another man's lips bending towards hers. "As far as you know," said Savannah. Joy blinked. "I didn't mean to imply anything by that," said Savannah. "Of course you didn't," said Joy. "You're right, as far as I know." "You were lucky," said Savannah thoughtfully, "to meet your soulmate when you were so young." "Soulmate," repeated Joy. "I don't know about that. He was just a boy. He's not perfect. I'm not perfect. When you're young, you get so worked up about things you think you could never forgive, like, I don't know, birthdays?" Savannah lifted a crumb of the apple crumble topping and rubbed it between her fingertips. "Like forgetting a birthday?" "That sort of thing, yes," said Joy, although she'd never cared that much about birthdays or anniversaries. She wanted to say, "Oh, darling, you've no idea." She remembered that day they were all driving to the Northumberland Open on the Central Coast, and the boys wouldn't stop fighting in the back seat, and she could feel Stan becoming unnaturally still in the driver's seat, and her stomach was churning in anticipation, and she turned and hissed at the children violently, silently contorting her face to try to make them stop. It was during the height of the battles between Logan and Troy when it seemed like each argument between them was a matter of life and death. and then Stan put on his indicator. His flicker. That's what they used to call the indicator back then. Funny how words disappeared, became quaint and ridiculous, like fashions and opinions you once held dear. He put on his flicker, stopped the car, undid his seatbelt, got out, closed the door, and Joy thought, "You must be joking, Stan, we're on a highway." But he wasn't joking. He missed that day's matches. The kids all lost their matches. Bizarre behaviour. Husbands could do worse. That's what she'd always told herself. She knew of husbands who hit or shoved or shouted terrible abuse. If Janet Higby lost a game on a double fault, her husband tweaked her nose and said, "Stupid goose." Janet always laughed merrily, but it wasn't funny. Anyone could see that it hurt and humiliated her. And poor Janet was annoying, but she didn't deserve her nose tweaked just because her ball toss was too low. Joy remembered another club member from years ago, a pretty girl called Polly Perkins, who was an absolute demon on the court, not scared of coming to the net, as aggressive as any man, but had to record every cent she spent in a little notebook for her husband, a hotshot university professor. Once, Polly told Joy about a terrible argument she and her husband had the previous night because he wouldn't give her permission to buy a new iron. Polly said the old iron kept spitting rust stains onto her clothes. She showed Joy the brown dots on her white tennis skirt. 6 months later, Polly walked out on her husband and moved back home to New Zealand, and Joy often thought of her when she did the ironing and hoped that she'd found happiness and a new iron that didn't spit rust. A husband could leave, like Stan, but a husband could also never return, like Joy's father. Stan always came back. The truth was that most of the time, Stan was more patient and less prone to anger than Joy. When the kids were little, her mood remained set at a permanent low level of simmering irritability. Did he not think that she too dreamed of walking straight out of her life when she got angry? She regularly fantasized about doing what her father had done all those years ago. Walk out the door to see a friend and never come back. Sometimes she abrogated responsibility by fantasizing about kidnappers bursting into the house, bundling her into the back of their van and taking her away for a long rest in a nice, cool, quiet dungeon. But walking out the door was never a real option. She was too necessary. Only she knew the children's schedules, where everything was, the vet's name, the doctor's name, the teacher's name. But Stan could walk out without a moment's thought. Sometimes he simply left the room, and that was fine. Normal people did that. Sometimes he walked around the block, and perhaps normal people did that too. Sometimes he went for a drive and came back an hour later, 2 hours later, three, four. The longer he went, the less normal it became. The longest time was 5 days. "Here's what you do," Joy's mother said when Joy finally confided in her about her husband's strange, shameful habit. "Make sure you're wearing lipstick and your nicest dress when he walks back in the door. Don't cry, don't shout, don't ask a single question about where he's been. Hold your head up high and act as if you didn't even notice he was gone." She'd followed her mother's instructions to the letter. If she gave those same instructions to her daughters, they would have howled. She only broke her mother's rule once. It was late at night, and she and Stan were in bed, the door shut, both still breathing heavily from sex. "Why do you do that?" she'd whispered into his chest. "Disappear. Walk out." At first, she'd thought he wasn't going to answer, and then he finally spoke. "I can't talk about it," he said. I'm sorry.
It's okay, she'd said. And it was okay, but it also wasn't okay. There were tiny seeds of bitter resentment at the center of her heart, like the tiny bitter seeds at the center of even the sweetest apple. They never talked of it again. When she said, it's okay, she accepted the deal. He always came back, and it only happened maybe once, twice a year, and as his hair grayed and receded and eventually vanished and his cartilage crumbled, he did it less and less, until one day she realized it was something from their past, like his long, curly black hair, like her PMT. You have to make compromises in a relationship, she said to Savannah. You muddle along. She stopped because she could see Savannah watching a woman and a little girl in a pale pink leotard and tutu who were sitting at the next table. The girl's hair was pulled back in one of those ferociously smooth ballet buns. Cute, she said to Savannah. I did classical ballet. Savannah's eyes were still on the child. Did you? Said Joy with interest. In spite of Savannah having said that she had highly superior autobiographical memory, she hadn't shared all that many of those memories that she remembered in such superior detail, presumably because they weren't such good memories. It was nice to get a new concrete detail. It made sense, too. Savannah had that beautiful straight-backed posture and a kind of grace to her movements. My mother would have loved me to do ballet. Did one of your foster carers get you into it? Asked Joy. Savannah looked at her with unfocused eyes. Huh? The ballet, said Joy. How did you get into ballet? It didn't seem like a typical pastime for a child shunted between foster homes, particularly classical ballet. Oh, said Savannah. I just did a few introductory lessons. That's all. She looked at the little girl and her lip curled. She shouldn't be eating a cupcake if she wants to be a ballerina. So much sugar. She spat the words out through thin, pursed lips. She sounded once again like someone else. Joy wondered if she were unconsciously imitating some awful authority figure from her life. Savannah pushed aside her apple crumble with contempt, as if someone had been forcing her to eat it. I've had enough of this. Yes, me too, said Joy. She sipped her tea and looked again at the little ballet dancer, her tan stockinged legs kicking as she happily munched on her cupcake. Joy felt all at once desolate, because she knew that Savannah had just lied to her about ballet, and Joy didn't understand the lie. But if she was lying about that, then perhaps Joy's children were right about Savannah, and she so didn't want her children to be right about Savannah. Joy? Said a familiar voice. And Joy quickly rearranged her face into one of warm sympathy for her widowed friend, Debbie Christos, who had walked into the cafe, which was disconcerting because Joy had moments earlier been thinking about her dainty wrists and also about kissing her dead husband. Chapter 31. Now. I actually met that girl the police want to talk to, said Debbie Christos to her friend Su Lin Ho. I bumped into Joy at the David Jones cafeteria last year. They'd been out shopping. I remember thinking they looked like mother and daughter. I heard about her, of course, said Su Lin, but I never met her. Su Lin was driving Debbie to Monday night tennis, as she had done for the last month. Losing one's husband, like so many of life's milestones, had turned out to be an interesting test of friendship. Debbie had lost friends, like the one who imperiously told her not to wallow in her grief when she didn't want to go to the theatre,
and she deepened her friendship with others, like Sue Lin, who was not a widow, yet seemed to intuitively understand the way Debbie felt 6 months after losing Dennis. So raw and sensitive, the very air was harsh against her skin. Sue Lin hadn't said, "Let me know if there's anything I can do for you, Debbie." She'd said, "I'll pick you up at 7. When Debbie's son delivered the eulogy at Dennis's funeral, he said, "Dad died doing what he loved," just after he'd won the match at Monday Night Tennis. Debbie wished he'd let her fact-check his speech. Dennis had won the point, not the game, and certainly not the match. They were playing against Joy and Stan, and no one beat the Delaneys. About 20 people listening to that eulogy would have thought, "In your dreams, Dennis." "What was she like?" asked Sue Lin. "The girl." "I don't know," admitted Debbie. "I didn't take much notice of her. I wish I had. I've been looking back, trying to remember things that Joy said or did, if she seemed unhappy or depressed, but she seemed fine. She was fine with me anyway." "Oh, where is Joy?" said Sue Lin suddenly as they stopped at a traffic light. She turned to look at Debbie. "It's just not like her, is it?" "No," said Debbie. "It is not like her, not at all. That's what worries me." It was 17 days now. Both Debbie and Sue Lin had been part of an organised search yesterday through bushland near the bike path that circled the St Helens Reserve. The bike path was the closest biking area to the Delaneys, and Joy had received a new bike from her son Troy at Christmas, which she supposedly loved, although not a single person had ever seen her riding it. The four adult Delaney children had taken part in the search. Stan Delaney had not. Debbie didn't know what to make of that, although a lot of other people knew exactly what to make of it. "There's something I've been thinking about," said Sue Lin now, her eyes fixed on the road ahead. "It was last October." She looked worried, as if she were confessing something. "I was driving home from book club about 9 o'clock at night when I saw a man sitting in the gutter on Beaumont Road. I thought it was some drunk teenager, but then the headlights caught his face and I thought, that's Stan Delaney."
"Sitting in the gutter?"
Debbie was scandalised. Stan Delaney was not the sort of man to sit in a gutter. He was far too tall.
"I know. So I pulled over and he told me he'd been out walking and tripped and hurt his knee again. It just seemed odd because he was wearing jeans. He certainly wasn't dressed for exercise. It was more like he'd wandered out of the house."
"Gosh," said Debbie.
"Yes, and something else," said Sue Lin carefully. "I think, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure he'd been crying."
"Crying?" said Debbie. She tried to work it out. "Because of his knee?" Men did get tearier as they got older.
"There was something going on," said Sue Lin. "I know there was, because I helped him into the car and drove him back home, and all four children were there at the house. I didn't get the feeling it was a celebration of any sort, that's for sure. It was more like they'd just got terrible news. Something had happened. The atmosphere. You know how you just know? You could cut the air with a knife."
"Was the girl still staying with them then? Savannah?" asked Debbie.
"I didn't see her," said Sue Lin. "I think she must have been gone by then. By the way, I haven't told anyone else that.
She took her eyes off the road and shot Debbie a brief, anxious look.
I don't know if I should.
I don't know if you should either, said Debbie. She thought of the gossip and rumours swirling about the tennis club. Joy and Stan's marriage had become public property. Everyone had an opinion to give. Some people said they'd never seen a happier partnership, on or off the court. People were in awe of the way the Delaneys silently communicated when they played doubles, switching spots without a word. It was like they had a telepathic connection. You never heard the anguished cries of other married couples. Yours! No, yours! I said I had it! When they won, which they invariably bloody did, Stan would lift Joy up like she was a child, spin her around and kiss her smack bang on the lips. Others were eager to explain that it was all a front. People were sharing the subtle signs they'd witnessed over the years of marriage difficulties, violence, unhappiness, infidelity, and financial trouble. Late last year, Joy had begun coming to Monday night tennis on her own. It was supposedly because of Stan's latest knee injury, but still. And then Joy herself had stopped coming sometime around Christmas. It felt like an awful invasion of privacy to hear people discussing the Delaney marriage. It was as if people were rummaging through Joy and Stan's bedroom. And in fact, everyone knew how Barb McMahon had found Joy's phone under the marital bed. It made Debbie feel obscurely angry, and she knew it had something to do with all the opinions people now had about her life and choices. When Dennis was alive, she was part of a solid, respectable, unassailable unit, Mr. and Mrs. Christos. But the moment he died, she was untethered, an elderly lady living alone. She was vulnerable, said her son. She must be so lonely, said her daughter. It all came from a place of love, but sometimes she wanted to scream. Thank God for Sue Lynn, who still treated her like a person. We'll play hard tonight, said Sue Lynn, for Joy. Distract ourselves. Yes, said Debbie. She saw the old folksy Delaney sign with the smiling tennis ball on the skyline. Everyone still called the courts and clubhouse Delaney's, even though Joy and Stan had sold the tennis school over a year ago. It was not as if the Delaneys had ever owned the courts. They leased them from the local council. But it was true that Joy and Stan had been the ones who led the way in lobbying the council to build them in the first place. Debbie and Dennis had been there at that first meeting with the council. Joy did most of the talking. They were all four founding members of the tennis club. They'd been so young, with no idea of their youth or beauty. For many years, Stan was president and Dennis was treasurer, and Joy and Debbie made sandwiches. This seemed outrageous now. Joy should have been president and Debbie should have been treasurer. She was a bookkeeper, but they hadn't thought anything of it at the time. Dennis's death had made those years of their early marriage so much fresher in her mind. Was it just the slideshow her daughter had made for the funeral? There had been a photo of the four of them at a party at the clubhouse where they all got quite drunk on Joy's homemade Hawaiian punch. It had been so strange sitting in the chilly church, 74 years old in stockings, seeing herself up on the screen in her orange miniskirt. She could literally taste the sickly sweet punch and feel the fabric of that miniskirt against her thighs. It felt like it was all still there, that time of their lives, somewhere metaphysical, accessible through some magical means other than memory. Joy had been smiling sideways at Dennis over her glass of punch in that photo, while Dennis, with a huge handlebar moustache, looked back at her suggestively, and Debbie and Stan smiled unsuspectingly at the camera. Debbie had forgotten what a bombshell Joy used to be. Wasn't that the word Dennis once used for Joy? The Delaney bombshell? Debbie's daughter hadn't noticed that she'd chosen a photo for her father's memorial slideshow of him flirting with another woman. She'd been more intrigued by the 1970s refreshments, cheese and pickled onions on toothpicks stuck in oranges so they looked like hedgehogs. Oh, my God, Mum, what are those things? Had Debbie been the only one at that funeral to see that photo flash by and wonder if anything had ever gone on between Dennis and Joy? It was very possible. Dennis was no angel. Debbie had been a bit wild herself. They'd both had flings in the early years of their marriage, before the children were born. Nothing important. She wouldn't have used the word affairs. Just a bit of fun. No feelings were hurt. Or not that badly hurt. They'd even been to a key party once. How did we find the energy? They marvelled once they reached their 50s. They'd never told their children. Young people today were strangely puritanical about sex, even as they pouted their lips and flaunted their bottoms online. "Whatever happened to topless sunbaking?" Dennis had said gloomily at one of their last trips to the beach. Debbie, trying to be helpful, had pointed to a group of girls in G-string bikinis. "Nah, they just look silly," Dennis had said. He was a boob man. Joy had been wearing a low-cut top in that photo. Dennis hadn't been admiring Joy's pretty eyes, that's for sure. Debbie wouldn't be cross with Joy if she had slept with Dennis. She wouldn't send her a thank you card, but she wouldn't hold it against her. It was all such a long time ago. It surely had nothing to do with Joy's disappearance. Unless it indicated that Joy was a serial cheater. Had she run off with a paramour? Who could be bothered at their age? Perhaps Joy could be bothered. She'd always been so energetic. Sue Lynn parked and Debbie's back twanged as she got out of the car, just to remind her that she wasn't actually 30, no matter the freshness of her memories. "Steel yourself," said Sue Lynn as she locked the car. "Mark Higby approaches." Mark Higby played the Monday night social comp with immense gravitas, bouncing the ball about 400 times each time he served and stopping to mop his brow with a towel in between games as if it were the Australian Open. He also had that horrible habit of tweaking his poor wife's nose, which made Debbie want to punch his. "Ah, this man is a stupid egg," said Sue Lynn under her breath. And Debbie shot her a surprised look because Sue Lynn never normally had a bad word to say about anyone. He walked towards them, tall, thin and grey-bearded, a giant racket bag slung over his shoulder. "Salutations, ladies," he said with an amused smile. He saw women as dear little inferior beings. "You heard the latest about Joy?" His face was bloated with the pleasure of delicious, shocking gossip. "No," said Sue Lynn in a chilly tone. "You do know she's missing," said Mark. "For goodness sake, of course we do," snapped Sue Lynn. "We both helped with the search yesterday." "It's obvious that Stan is their, quote-unquote, chief suspect," said Mark, oblivious to her snappiness. He caressed his bearded chin with his thumb and index finger as if he were parodying a professor deep in thought. "But without a body, they're royally screwed." "Without a body," said Debbie. "You don't mean Joy's body?" "Of course I do," said Mark, as if he'd never heard anything so stupid. "Who else's body would I mean, Debbie?" Debbie thought of Joy's lovely tanned legs. The woman never stood still. She'd brought around a lasagna when Dennis died, in a baking tray, and then instantly confessed that she hadn't baked it. She'd bought it from the Italian deli and tried to transfer it to the dish to make it look homemade. She'd looked so guilty, it had made Debbie laugh.
You've got to face facts, said Mark paternally. It's unlikely she's alive. Stan had scratch marks on his face. What does that tell you?
There are many ways that could happen, said Su Lin, but her voice faltered with the horror of it.
The police might be calling it a missing persons investigation, said Mark, but anyone with a brain knows they're treating it as a murder investigation.
She texted all her children that she was going away, said Debbie.
It's not exactly hard to send a text from someone else's phone, said Mark. The phone was still at the house. Barb McMahon found it hidden under their bed.
Stan doesn't know how to text, said Debbie, if that's what you're implying.
So he says, said Mark.
Debbie said, Stan is our friend. You shouldn't say things like this.
I heard there was an affair, said Mark.
His eyes sparkled. Debbie had never seen the man so cheerful.
They had an attractive 20-something girl staying at their house last year, a quote-unquote family friend, and I'm guessing that when Joy was in hospital, the temptation was too much for Stan. You know, when the cat's away, the mice do tend to play.
Stop it, said Debbie. Just stop talking. I do not believe a word of it. But it was hard now not to put that together with Su Lin's story of Stan sitting in the gutter last year, crying. Mark raised his palms.
Don't shoot the messenger, Debbie. Keep this to yourselves, but I have a theory about where he's buried the body.
Su Lin said, we're not interested in your theory, Mark.
Under their court, said Mark. They had it resurfaced. Perfect place to hide a body. I told the police, guys, you need to dig up that tennis court. I think they probably will. You heard it here first.
But wait, they resurfaced it back in January, began Debbie. Mark barreled on.
Not only that, I saw Stan, covered in dust, bloodshot eyes, buying chocolate milk at the mini-mart down on Hastings Street 2 days after Joy went missing. I said, Stan, what happened to you? He ignored me, literally ignored me, as if I didn't exist. Told the police about that too.
You think he buried her body and then went and bought himself a chocolate milk? Asked Su Lin.
That's exactly what I think, said Mark. Burying a body is thirsty work.
That's not funny, said Debbie.
It's not funny, Debbie. It's an absolute tragedy, said Mark cheerfully. I also told the police they should look into that son of theirs, the one driving about in the poser cars, who supposedly makes all his money doing online trading. He used to deal drugs. Know that for a fact, because he sold them to my son.
Troy, said Debbie. Troy had dated her daughter. She knew Troy had dated a lot of people's daughters, but she still had a soft spot for him.
That was when he was a teenager, Mark. I think we've all moved on. I told the police they needed to look at possible money laundering, maybe an international white-collar crime syndicate. Who knows how he makes all his money?
So, wait, now you're saying you think Troy had something to do with his mother's disappearance? Said Su Lin.
Anything is possible, ladies.
Mark shifted the racket bag on his shoulder and sauntered off.
See you on the court. Oh, fuck you, Mark Higby, said Su Lin.
And Debbie was fairly confident this was the first time that particular word had ever crossed her friend's lips. Chapter 32.
Do you reckon the husband had an affair? Asked Ethan.
He and Christina were walking from the car down the endless gravel driveway of a stately home to take a statement for their schoolboy arsonist case. But they were discussing, as they usually were these days, the Joy Delaney investigation. With this Savannah girl? It's a possibility, said Christina. There's a whole lot that family isn't telling us. Protecting their father? I assume so, said Christina. Or protecting themselves. She did a mental lineup of the four Delaney children as potential suspects. Amy Delaney, skittish as a small-time criminal. Logan Delaney, calm as an experienced one. Troy Delaney, smooth as a slippery salesman. Except Christina didn't know what he was selling, and she felt like maybe he didn't know either. Brooke Delaney, circumspect as a spy. Could one or more of them be responsible for their mother's disappearance? Or was it more likely that one of them aided and abetted their father? If my father had an affair with a young girl and then my mother went missing, mused Ethan as they stepped onto an arched and columned portico fit for a prince or a poor, misunderstood little arsonist and rang the doorbell, I'd throw him straight under the bus. Me too, said Christina. She bit on the ragged thumbnail she was meant to be leaving alone for her wedding day. So why, then, were the Delaneys being so cagey? She said, did their mother let them down in some way? Mothers can do that, said Ethan. And she was wondering if he meant that in a general or specific sense, when the arsonist's mother opened the door, her son's guilt written all over her exquisitely renovated face. Chapter 33. Last October. Troy couldn't make himself care or focus. The market was quiet, but not that quiet. His heart wasn't in it. He'd made only one trade in the last 2 hours. That was a signal he should stop for the day according to his own rules, and rule number one was follow your own rules. He looked away from his monitors at the floor-to-ceiling windows, where a solitary seagull wheeled across a cloudless, pale blue sky. The rippling harbour loomed ahead of him like a landing strip. He'd landed a 747 at Salzburg Airport once. It was a flight simulator experience, a gift for his 30th birthday from his ex-wife. The instructor said he had excellent instincts. Troy was now confident he could land a plane if the pilot got in trouble and the beautiful, panicked flight attendant came running from the cockpit, begging any passenger with flying experience to come forward. Could have been an airline pilot. Could have won Wimbledon. Could have been a married soccer dad in the suburbs who made his mother a grandmother, like she deserved to be, instead of donating his kid to another man, making the other man the soccer dad, standing there on the sidelines, cheering on Troy's kid, who would be fucking good at soccer, because the Delaneys were good at all sports, not just tennis. Troy would let his kid play any sport he wanted to play, but not this particular kid, because it wouldn't be his kid. It was stupid to get sentimental. If he really wanted a kid, he could have one, no problem. Claire had been the one with the problem. Troy had a high sperm count and excellent motility. That is just so typical, Claire had said when she read his sperm analysis, back when she still loved him. He'd been relieved. He hadn't slept the night before they got his results, terrified that the test would reveal a secret hidden failing. His father got his mother pregnant just by looking at her. Of course he did. Handing over the embryos was the generous, kind, altruistic thing to do, except he couldn't pretend to be an altruist, because if Claire had cheated on him, he would have been vengeful as hell. He would have said, let those little suckers thaw, give them to science, chuck them in the bin. He was paying an overinflated price for a not especially satisfying sexual episode with a girl whose name he couldn't remember, although he remembered her job and her perfume, pharmaceutical sales executive, and white linen. He'd never liked that scent, but now he detested it. He remembered going home afterwards in a cab, looking out on rain-sodden city streets, opening the cab window in a fruitless attempt to make the stench of her perfume and his regret go away. No regrets. That was another of his trading rules. Never waste time thinking about what could have been. He hadn't given Claire his answer yet. He'd been holding out hope for a last-minute reprieve, a reason to refuse her. Right now, it was dinner time in Texas. He imagined her sitting down to dinner with her husband. Any word yet, honey? They must hate having their future dreams dependent on him. The Texan cardiologist would never break Claire's heart. The guy was a heart specialist, after all. He probably treated Claire's heart with all the specialist loving tenderness she deserved. Troy hoped he did treat her heart tenderly, even as he wished he didn't. He wished he hadn't hurt her. He didn't understand why he'd done it, except that all through his life he'd been at the mercy of a powerful desire, the desire to blow everything up. What if I put the tip of my finger against that fragile ornament my mother said not to touch, and not only do I touch, I push? What if, halfway through a boring geography lesson, I stand up and walk out without saying a single word? What if I jump off that bridge with the sign that says, no jumping? Take that pill? Go for that impossible shot? What if I pick up a girl at a city bar while my wife is going through IVF to have a baby we both supposedly want? It was like an invisible force took hold of him. Do it, do it, do it. The girl meant nothing. She was just a girl sitting next to him at a bar with giant teeth and a harsh laugh. Claire was smarter, funnier, and prettier. Her teeth were perfectly sized, and her laugh was beautiful. His actions were inexplicable. It was all kinds of fucked up. You must have wanted an excuse to get out, Claire had said, her face ashen. And it was true. He must have wanted an excuse to get out of the relationship, although he wasn't consciously aware of wanting to get out. But why else had he done it? And more to the point, why had he instantly confessed the moment he got home before he'd even taken off his shirt? While Claire looked up from her book in their bed and smiled, and the cells of their potential children multiplied and divided in a Sydney clinic. It was called self-sabotage, according to Amy, who was the only one in his family who kind of understood, because she had a tendency towards it herself, although even she took a long time to forgive him for breaking her beloved sister-in-law's heart. Enough! Troy slammed both fists on his desk so hard that his three oversized monitors rattled. He did not do this. What was done was done. He walked to the windows of his home office and pressed his forehead against the glass. Every single person in the world who came to his apartment talked about the incredible views, except for his brother. Logan had walked into this room, laughed out loud, clipped Troy on the back of the head and said, Jesus, mate. Maybe that was his way of saying it was incredible, but why couldn't he just say it was incredible? Why was it funny? Just give him credit for the view, for Christ's sake. Even their father had said, bloody good view. Although Stan followed it up with, hope you can afford it. Sometimes he wanted to show his dad his bank statements, like a preschooler giving him a finger painting. Look what I did, Daddy. I got rich without tennis, Daddy. Except not as rich as Harry fucking Haddad. Troy kept a permanent eye on the dickhead's net worth. He went back to his desk, opened his email, typed in Claire's name and wrote the message. Fast. Dear Claire, I've thought about it. It's fine. Go ahead. Make it happen. I'll sign all the forms you need. Love, Troy. He pressed send. He looked at his hands still resting on the keyboard. What had he just done? Those words were now on a computer screen in Texas. It felt inappropriately futuristic. A message of that significance should have been sent in a handwritten letter that took months to cross the ocean. But everything about this moral dilemma had once been impossibly, laughably futuristic. Frozen microscopic babies waiting to be brought to life. She could be reading it right now. He tried to imagine his ex-wife's face. What would she think of the word love? He would never have said yes if he didn't still love her. The thought hit him like a punch in the nose. It wasn't just about redemption. It was about love. Was the email he just sent his first ever act of unconditional love? The most unselfish act of his life? To zero out the most selfish one? His apartment buzzer rang. He walked to the security monitor in a daze. Hello, he said roughly. A face loomed in the screen. He took an instant step back, appalled. It was Savannah. What did she want? Something must have happened to his parents. Was his mother back in the hospital? Had his father hurt his knee again? Oh, hi, Troy. It's Savannah. Here. She leaned in even closer to the camera. Your mother's friend? Her voice crackled through the speaker. Your mother's friend. That was a strange way to put it. He waited. He pressed the speaker and said, Are my parents okay? They're fine. Can I come in? He looked around his apartment. He felt an overwhelming, irrational sense of resistance to the idea of Savannah being here, her rabbit-like eyes darting back and forth, evaluating and judging. He had no idea if that judgment would be negative or positive. All he knew was that she would be far too interested in everything she saw. But he could hardly say no, not when she'd been taking care of his parents, preparing their meals, even doing their laundry, apparently. She'd cooked that extraordinary Father's Day lunch, the best food Troy had ever eaten in his family home. She'd been the one to grab hold of Troy's mother, supporting her safely to the floor when she'd fainted. She'd said, Call an ambulance, while Troy's family all froze, their minds still trying to catch up. Instead of Savannah feeling indebted to them, the family was increasingly feeling indebted to her, and that was making everyone feel off balance. Amy, Logan, and Brooke had all recently left messages for Troy saying to call them urgently regarding the Savannah issue, and he hadn't yet called back. But now Savannah was here, at his place. Why not his brothers or sisters? He wanted to say, You've got the wrong guy. I'm busy. I've got other things going on. Come on up. It's the top floor. He pressed the buzzer. He looked around, trying to see his home through her eyes. Troy's apartment was meant to be minimalist yet glamorous, luxurious yet understated. But was it possibly pretentious? For one terrifying moment, a seismic tremor of doubt shook his entire belief system. His heart raced. Jesus, pull it together. He was turning into his sister. Next thing, he'd be in therapy. He opened the door to his apartment, his most devastating smile locked and loaded. Hi, said Savannah as she emerged from the lift. Wow. Have you got this whole floor to yourself? Not quite, His devastating smile faltered. There were two apartments on the top floor of the building, although his faced north, so it was the better one. Was she somehow making him feel bad about his multi-million-dollar north-facing Harbourview apartment with a rooftop infinity-edged pool? "Come in," he said. "This is a nice surprise." "Is it?" said Savannah. She looked different. She had a kind of stylish bohemian look going on. Yoga teacher with money. "You look great," said Troy. He felt an unexpected surge of attraction. She wore a long pendant with a greenish-coloured stone. It somehow complemented the trashy key necklace she always wore. Her hair was tied up in a half-up, half-down way that no longer reminded him so strongly of his mother's style. Not quite as voluminous. "Your mother bought me all this," Savannah gestured at her outfit. "Your mother has been very good to me."
"You've been good to her," said Troy carefully, because she seemed to be making a point. "Can I get you a drink? Tea or coffee?"
"No, I think I'll just get straight to it," said Savannah.
"Right then," said Troy.
It was like this was a prearranged business meeting. He indicated his custom-made white leather couch. Amy had managed to get chocolate on it last time she visited.
"Have a seat."
She sat at the very edge of the couch, feet together, back straight. She adjusted the pendant between her breasts. "Extraordinary view." She swept her arm in a quick, graceful arc, as if getting a required formal acknowledgement out of the way. She didn't even look at the view.
"What can I do for you, Savannah?"
He sat in the Eames chair opposite her and smiled. She didn't smile back, which was disconcerting. People generally smiled back when Troy smiled. If he'd had to guess, he would have said she was here to ask him to invest in a crummy small business venture with little hope of turning a profit, like a nail salon or a vegan cafe. Although she was a good cook, so maybe she could turn a profit on a vegan cafe. She said, "While your mother was in hospital, and it was just your father and I alone, he..." She stopped, lowered her eyes, and fiddled with the green pendant, turning it this way and that, as if she were considering buying it.
"He what?"
She dropped the pendant and looked back at him steadily. Troy's heart stopped.
"No."
Her eyes held his, patiently, insistently, gently, like a doctor insisting you must understand that the cancer is incurable.
"I'm sorry, but he did."
"He didn't, actually. He made a very specific request, which I refused."
"You must have misunderstood," said Troy.
"There was no doubt," said Savannah. "I can give you his exact words, if you like."
Troy recoiled, held up his palm, tried to control his nausea.
"I was really upset," said Savannah, "because your parents seem so happily married, and I really love your mother. I think she's great, truly. I thought your dad was great, too."
She sighed, grimaced.
"I've been at sixes and sevens trying to decide what to do." She looked at the ceiling. "On the one hand, I think she deserves to know the truth."
"No," said Troy, "I don't think so."
It was unbearable. He could not bear to imagine his mother's pain, her shock, her shame. She would be so embarrassed. How dare his father do this? His father, who had spent Troy's whole life sitting up there on his umpire's chair, judging Troy's every action. I don't understand how you could lose control of yourself like that, Stan had said after Troy jumped the net and attacked Harry for his flagrant cheating, propelled by white-hot rage. It was as though Troy had lost control of his bowels in public. I just don't understand it. Troy had seen that same disgust each time he transgressed throughout his life, except there was never again disbelief, just resignation, as if it were to be expected now, as if once again Troy had proven himself to be exactly as disgusting as his father knew him to be. You're a fool, his father had said when Troy cheated on Claire. She was too good for you. I know, Troy had said. That's why I did it, Dad, before she noticed. His father's betrayal felt like his own betrayal, as if he had been the one to make a move on Savannah. Hadn't Troy just moments ago felt a faint flicker of desire for this girl? He might have acted on the very same desire his father had acted upon. As his young house guest, young enough to be his daughter or even his granddaughter, walked past him in Troy's family home. Did his father think Savannah would feel obliged, that he had some power over her because she had nowhere else to go, because she'd already been knocked around by one guy? Did he forget that he was Stan Delaney, retired tennis coach in old man slippers, not Harvey Weinstein in a bathrobe? Jesus Christ. Mum is too good for you, Dad. Or did he think, no harm trying, worth a shot, because he didn't get much these days? Ah, for fuck's sake, now he was thinking about his parents having sex and his father having sex with Savannah, and it was quite possible that Troy's own sex life would be irretrievably damaged by this single moment. Or was this just part of an ongoing pattern of behaviour? Had his father cheated before? It had always been a possibility in the back of Troy's mind that the reason for their father